Hello, everyone. That's very true what Neil just said, actually. I can say that staying alive did indeed get me writing much later in my life than the poets that we're going to hear from tonight, all of whom are winners of the Foyle Young Poet Award in the last years. And for those of you that don't know about the Foyle, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a background to say it's the largest competition that exists for young people, for young poets, aged 11 to 17. And it began in 1998. Its mission is to find, celebrate and support the best young poets, not from just the UK, but around the world. And I've had the pleasure of judging that competition in 2013, when there were something like 15,000 entries, as there were in 2015, from 5,846 young poets from every postcode in the UK and from 69 countries. It really is a completely international competition. There's not just one winner of the Foyle every year, but 15 winners and 100 altogether. So there's 15 winners and 85 commended poets. The 15 winners get to spend a week on an Arvon residential course with the judges of the competition, tutoring them. And the 100 all receive the kind of ongoing support from the Poetry Society and the opportunities that the Poetry Society can offer them. So now I'll get on with introducing the poets. We're going to hear from four poets tonight, and I'll introduce them each and then let them read so that you can kind of have them clear in your mind as they're reading their poetry to you. So I'll begin with Flora de Falb, who is the young poet in residence here at Ledbury this year. She comes from London and is currently studying at Cambridge. She was a Foyle Young Poet winner in 2011 and 12, and also won the Ledbury Young People's Poetry Prize in 2012. In 2015, more recently, she won Cambridge's John Kinsella Prize and was highly commended in the Poetry Book Society student competition. She's had her work widely published in some of the leading poetry journals, Magma, Ambit, and with the Emma Press. And tonight, she's going to be reading some newer work for us. Okay, so if we could everyone give a welcome to Flora de Falb.
This is called What She Said to the Old Man. I am searching for my sister. She is small and has small hands. Please tell me if you see her. Her limbs are made of china. Her face is seashell pretty. Most people want to touch her. I worry she will shatter. She has been gone for days now. Her friends all say they miss her. Let me show you a picture. Like me, but better featured. Well, now you'll recognize her. For years, I used to wonder why I was not as delicate, as breakable and small as her. But now it doesn't matter. I find it hard to sleep at night when I am not beside her. I'm worried for my mother. We don't know what we'll find, if we ever find her. I'm searching for my sister. Please tell me if you see her. I've lost my little sister. Sorry, that's out of the way. My grandma is in trouble with my family at the moment, with the younger generations, because she voted for Brexit without knowing what Brexit was. So this is a poem about happier times. This is called Libra, because my grandma and I share a birthday. Sometimes I joke my grandma is one day older than me, and we play at being balanced. Because we're written in the stars, there is nothing to do but drink tea from her zodiac mugs. Nothing to fix, nothing to prove. Whatever I hold in my left hand also appears in my right. I am a slave to the scales, to their cold round hands, to their hard square digits, to the two silver fish born too deep in winter to grasp what makes an equilibrium. Sometimes Grandma and I pretend we understand our horoscope. She wants to know that today is a day of opportunities. I want to know that I'm indecisive so that I can be indecisive. Spinning above us is her past and my future, exact in equivalence. I don't send my poems to my mum very often, and this poem is an illustration of why, because I sent a poem to my mum, and I got an email back saying, I'm worried that you have a thyroid problem. So this is a response to that. This is called Poem in Which I Do Not Have a Thyroid Problem. This is the poem I will send to my mother, who is worried about the death of the author. She is worried her daughter is losing weight. She is worried my thyroid is making me fat. Mother, I don't know what a thyroid is, and the reason I sleep so much is this. I need to find out what I'm sleeping for. You know how bored I get at the doctor. Last time I nodded off and woke to find him sluicing his hands at the sink and three plastic pots of the blood he'd taken, which, having left me, was no longer mine. That's the kind of death I want. Mother, decant me bit by bit. I am sleeping to dream of a mirror which shows the thyroid and not the daughter. Apparently the reason I have a thyroid problem is that I write a lot about sleeping. So this is another example of that. It's called Narcoleptic Love Song. If the sleeping won't do it, I don't know what will. I can drowse under eyelids as heavy as gold. I can curl like a fist round the hilt of my longing. I can doze like a kitten. Baby, I'm cold. I slept for a year once on somebody's sofa. Woke up with a pair of spectacular wings. People were setting their clocks by my breathing. I yawned and sucked most of the furniture in. Baby, the night makes a face at my window. I want you to want me with nothing to hide. There are pins in the soles of my feet and my head hurts. Through sleep, only sleep, are we purified. I sleep like a scarf thrown aside in a hurry. I sleep like a moon rendered briefly complete, my knees to my chest and my lips almost touching. My toes are still chilly. How do you sleep? Two things I don't write are love poems and sonnets. So this is one of those, but I think the only way, one of both of those, but I think the only way that I could approach it was by writing about the least romantic thing that I could think of. So this is a love poem. It's a sonnet called Cystitis. The doctor leaves after the ultrasound to help another pregnant woman through. I wipe my empty belly clean of goo and ride the elevator to the ground. What am I carrying except a bladder, so sore I spend all morning in the loo? Part of me thinks that it's a part of you, making me dream the sound of running water. Months later, I'm in hospital again, clenching my fists. And this, the pot of pee delivered to the nurse's plastic glove, is liquid proof that happiness buys pain. This is the concentrate of you and me. This is one of the things I do for love. This last poem, I don't know if anyone remembers Mark Grist's spoken word poem, Girls Who Read. There was lots of people got very angry about it because it's a poem about how he only dates girls who read and how he's meant to be a great guy because he's commodifying the fact that she reads rather than her body. So I wrote a response to that from the perspective of a girl who reads, an abstract girl who reads, I should specify, and sort of thinking about some of the things that our culture tells girls who read, which I think are not necessarily healthy either. So this is a poem called Men Who Murder. Some girls want a man with blue, starry eyes, or a man with a sense of humour. I want a man who murders. I'll know him by the thin red curve under his nails and the twist of scar across his left hand which says, I fight to win. I want a man who cuts throats like butter and kisses under his own code of honour. I want him to take me by the hand, heart, and windpipe. I want to fear nothing but him, to live on the verge of combustion. I want him to grip me like a dagger. I'm going to paint my lips red and mark him mine when the sun hits the gutter. I'm going to dress in red to hide the splatters. I want to stroke my man's hair when it's all over. I want to cry to my man from the bottom of a river. I don't want someone who thinks he deserves me. I want a man who murders. What else do I read books for? Before I hand over to these other lovely, talented people, I'd just like to say I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to make it this weekend because my godmother died very suddenly. And I came because I think she would have wanted me to be here because she was someone, she'd just got an OBE for services to the arts. She worked really tirelessly for young people in theatre and in spoken word recently. So I'd just like to dedicate this reading to Nicola, who was a wonderful person. Thank you.
Thank you, Flora, for those lovely, funny, dark poems. And I was saying this morning to my partner, I wonder how long it will be at Ledbury before someone mentions Brexit. So I'm just glad we've got that out of the way and we're up and running. The next poet that I'm going to introduce to you, I think, must be the youngest of the poets that are reading here this evening, Jonathan Stone, who has just finished his A-levels. Well done for that. And he won the Young Foyle Poets in 2015, and we'll be hearing that winning poem now, I believe. Welcome, Jonathan Stone.
Hello. This first poem is the one I won with last year and is called... Picture a balloon, inflated to translucence. There are a number of ways in which this particular predicament can end. A, pinched by the neck, stretched such that it screams hilariously until it dies out of noise. B, let go to fly on flatulent wings, win a laugh, run out of fuel, then silence, then a sigh. C, held tight, too tight. Built up, then stuck with a spike. Hard luck, what a shock, pop. But those are all too loud for me. There are two more that I can think of, somewhat softer, somewhat not. D. Tied off. Maybe held down by string, maybe not. Maybe let go of, maybe left, maybe floated away, maybe the loft, maybe discovered again, maybe forgot, maybe it mercifully popped, but probably not. Probably only waited to rot, still there in name, shrank and shriveled and withered away, until even if anyone saw, no one could say precisely when it changed from one to the other, though they could all say whether. E. Here's another. Still holding the air or helium in, grip either side of the lip and pull. If you've the knack, the air should escape with no more noise than a gentle exhalation as it's released. Or if you prefer, relieved. That way it dies with the rubber still smooth, still of use, and still fresh in the mind. This next poem is much less grim, and has, in a way, the opposite title from the last one, because where that one only makes sense said and not written down, this one only makes sense written down, but I'll try and explain it. It's called Break. That being the word break with a question mark in quotation marks, as one would say before playing a game of pool, asking the other person if they wanted to break. It's a sonnet called Break. Oh, thanks. You curl your fingers round the cue, taking a nervous aim and strike the white, scatter the wedge of coloured balls. Now you and I will play together for the night. We've work to do, no doubt, but nothing fun, or not as much as this. I watch you play, leg over, bent. You pot another one, but we can't hear it rolling on its way back to the others. Stuck. I slide my hand into the pocket. You search the return. We feel around. I flinch back from your hand. We have more than the rules of pool to learn. We could talk man to man. We could be clear together. You and I play on in fear. This next poem is called Ortolan, which is named after the Ortolan bunting, which is a species of songbird that for the last few centuries until a few decades ago was eaten in Western Europe as a delicacy in this very specific, very ritualized way, and then was banned for being too inhumane or it was endangered or something along those lines. So it's called Ortolan, or ethical consumption. Eyes punctured like a cocktail olive, kept in a lifelong nighttime, fed, force-fed, ballooned with fat, and all its warbles drowned in Armagnac. Roasted whole, held finger and thumb and dropped onto the tongue, feet first, beak, hollow bones and all, to crunch. The diners wear a napkin as a veil to hide their decadence from God, tradition says, as if they thought he could be hidden from. They didn't hide. They told themselves they hid. Then mocking guilt swam in the boiling blood of what they did. And isn't that just awful, I tut, as I sit in my sweatshop shirt and tap at my Foxconn suicide phone and frown at the damning fingerprints of chicken fat. This next poem is dedicated to and about one of my fellow four young poets from this year, Ian McCartney. Fantastic poet, fantastic screenwriter, playwright, writes everything and writes constantly, incredibly prolific. I am not incredibly prolific. I'm a very, very slow writer, so this is about how jealous I am of him. It's called Donating. I pinch the pen like a first-timer with a condom wrapper, like a junior doctor with a scalpel, like a chess grandmaster with a castle in the final. Every line is wrung from it in turn, each word blood from a stone. This trick will work for sharper rocks, and gripping hard, hard, harder for hours until it hurts. I've never given blood. I asked and was reminded that our kind are too high risk, so much for that, but I digress. For those who aren't, they can't give more than half a pint with a month and a half in between. That's all I have. That's all I make every few weeks. Blood trickles from my open palm. I watch it clot. I turn my head in the blood drive van in the donor bed to you. On me, they opened a vein. Veins drip. Your every artery has been unzipped. A fountain pumps great soaring arcs of every kind of red around the room. The handshake of the radial, the blush of the carotid, the aorta's perfect, near perfect time, the kiss, tender vermilion of the labial. All this is you. Beneath your skin, the blue, the thistle, leukocytes in saltier white, the double helix of your recipe, the palette, every colour of your poetry. And I postpone my jealousy. That you write more than I could ever write is right and does not bother me. But as we bleed, a far more painful thought occurs to me. That you write more, that you are more than I could hope, could ever hope to read. My last poem is called The Off Switch and is addressed to Keith Douglas, who was a Second World War poet, for those of you who don't know, who wrote in this really detached style about all of the guilt and sadness about all of the things that he had to do as a soldier, stationed in, I think, Al Alamein in sort of African theatre of war. So it's called The Off Switch. Epigraph is, and look, has made a man of dust of a man of flesh. This sorcery I do, being damned, I am amused. Three traits: persistent bedwetting, animal cruelty, obsessive fire setting that any future killer is meant to have. How many helmets in your crosshairs do you think had one? Who knows? But you had none. Look at what you're doing, what you've done. From far away, it sounds the same. The plink of pellets punching holes in cans can as well be told from that of bullet holes in metal hats, as you could tell a burnt-out corpse from well-done steak by smell. You had it harder then. If you could see the way we kill today, you'd die of envy. We aim with screens. The tap of a key is a trigger squeeze. Not a man in a scope, but a thermal imaging smudge. Watch it go cold. The modern soldier does your sorcery from miles away without a face or name to make the victims human. But you managed. You made do. Somehow I think you always would have done. Drone or no drone, terror or the Hun, gun or no gun. We manage now to click a man to chunks, countries away, but you could burst the heads of Germans through your scope, scrunching your other eye so tightly shut you couldn't have batted an eyelid if you'd tried. But men have killed before. From cavalry back through the knights to spears and pikes, look back to Rome, the gladius, to Greece, the horse, in caves, the stick and string, the club, the rock, the apes, the hands. It's all the same in Baghdad, Agincourt, El Alamein. Thank you very much.
Fantastic reading. Thanks, Jonathan. Our next poet is Jasmine Sims, who is originally from West Yorkshire and is currently studying at Durham University, where she's Vice Chancellor Scholar for the Arts. She was commended in the Foyle in 2012 and has since won two Northern Writing Awards. And more recently, she's won the New North Poet of 2015. Intriguingly, Jasmine is about to move to Germany for a year to work in a democratic school, which I found very interesting. I don't really know what it is. If you're interested, you can ask Jasmine later. But from now, we're going to hear her poem. So welcome, Jasmine.
School. I wanted boyfriends who were good at science. In physics, I drew love hearts, or bent and unbent paper clips into the shape of love hearts. Whoever doesn't know what love is hasn't been to a physics lesson and dragged a toy car across a desk to test the forces on us. I tilted my hips and said, "Gravity is the best man, girls, he never leaves," and rolled myself across the carpet. First kiss was a boy who failed his science GCSE, and it was like being dropped into a conical flask. Outside, life went on. Inside, I started to believe in particles for the first time. Crawled my way back into the library under a duvet. Physics boy said, "If you split an atom, you find the world trembling like a newborn." And then I stopped holding it together. This next poem was written after a really crazy thing I did, having been at university for 1 month. I think the freshest craziness hadn't was still in my system, and we went on this wild hitchhiking adventure across Europe with a friend. Just before I did it, I didn't tell my mum, but I told a few people, and I was really interested in the sort of advice that you get before you do something like that, this kind of wild, kind of ranging advice, some of it very useful, a lot of it very contradictory, and this is a poem that came out of that. Hitching. First piece of advice: forget instincts. Learn by heart the better judgments of an anxious world. the sensible shoes and warm clothes, the impossible distance between countries, like doctrines. Far safer not to speak about religion. Become good at small talk, so small you could disappear in it, and do not sleep in the back seats, eyes pulled shut as though magnetized. Like how you slept at the back of classrooms, the judgments rumbling beneath you like submarines. Forget yourself. For small talk, use only the true facts remembered from biology. For example, that women blink more than men. You try to catch his eyes in the wing mirrors. He says women on the pill blink more than anyone. You would put this down to sleepiness. He would put this down to chemistry. Second piece of advice, never disagree. Every bad decision will keep us awake in the next place, like hitching our skirts up in the bathrooms, breathing bad words onto mirrors. But this time you gallop into sleep. You slide the doors of vans like lifting the skirts of girls. You wonder if you're dreaming when it starts to feel like school again, the autobahn dirty and wide as the humanities corridor, the boys in the submarine singing. And when your mother tells it as the story of the time you nearly died, you remember it as the time you could not stop blinking. One, I study education, so a lot of my poems are about school, maybe even the majority. And I also did a whole module in my degree this year on Harry Potter, so I reread all the Harry Potter novels. And this was one of the sort of inevitable Harry Potter poems that came out of that significant portion of my time this year. At Hogwarts. Because we have magic, we do not need the other things, like smoking and sex. There is no nakedness. No electronic bells and registers or bright lights to keep us awake. Not even smartphones. And because we live here, there is no start or end of days. We are dots on a map. Look, another boy escapes the dragon on the playing fields. Look, another girl has dropped dead in the bathroom. We play Quidditch into the long hours. Maybe because we are bored, we resurrect each other on weekends in the abandoned classroom. Today, I posted a letter to the dead parents, describing how it rains indoors at breakfast under the imaginary sky. We suffer from the weather here. Ofsted say we look so unhappy sitting here in the cloisters. Still, we will save the world. This one's about university. I'm at university in Durham. Durham's a really small place that's really dominated by this huge cathedral. And then the whole city is kind of full of religious icons. A lot of the churches are named after, a lot of the colleges are named after the Northern Saints. There's a lot of churches in Durham. I've really enjoyed the juxtaposition, I suppose, between the obvious religiousness of the town and then the nightlife, the drunken people outside the cathedral every evening. I find it quite beautiful. This is a poem, I suppose, inspired by that. St. Chad. Ordinary Durham lad, hauled up from the East Midlands to Aden's College. An undetectable accent. A secret library under his desk. His brother, said, also a saint, scored a hat-trick against George on the last day of term. Chad has been our friend ever since we started having boys for friends. It's not been easy. First, we couldn't get him to stop touching himself in our bathroom. Different definitions of sacred, we said. Then he wouldn't stop praying in the living room. Then he wouldn't stop telling us his dreams. Something changed us. Now we keep a monastery in our student house. Chad, we miss you. We who saw your elevation outside Oswald's, the drunken angels singing under the cathedral's huge shadow, the flashing blue light that chose you, beaming you back to wherever boys come from. This poem is just based on a dream I had. Recurring dream. In which I am one of those born without an oven in their stomachs, who shout at themselves in mirrors. Which is to say, the men. They are all around me, hanging about under extractor fans. An imposter, I stand in the white coat of my ex-boyfriend who we laughed at for taking food tech. But this is a manly job, isn't it? We wrap girls in tinfoil, weigh our height hearts until they are light enough. It's hard work. We move through tunnels and end up in the underworld, which is an indoor place. But here my brothers use their outdoor voices, an insecure frequency that sounds in the back of the mind like a man crying. They let me in. Heaven is a large, dark kitchen. Fill your boots, say the men at the table. This is all there is. My last poem is, there's a concept that's about a concept that's always been around, but it's become pretty trendy recently, I think, in academics, sort of conversations about labour and about gender in particular, emotional labour. A close friend of mine has just picked it up as a research interest, and she was telling me about it, and just sounded like one of those concepts that is begging to have a poem written about it. So this is for her. Emotional labour. Of course, the impossible part will be pricing things. After that, it's all invoices, trips to the hospital, healthy meals, anxious texts, the usual. You've been doing it for years, now you're cashing in. No more taking out his bins without a tip. No more smiles like blessings in the streets. And though you're not the first to realise we've given away too much for free, you are the first to set up shop in the business of caring. To stock shelves with grace. Here is the source of your profit. The beating heart, where old ladies bask in the triumph of your improbable venture. As for the naysayers, the protesters, the pragmatists, the man at the pub who, in the same night, lectured us on the stock market and bad sex, it is only because they have not felt your love yet, which crushes the economy under its huge weight, but grows everything it touches. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for that lovely reading. And our last poet this evening is Charlotte Higgins, who is studying at Cambridge and was a FOIL Young Poet in 2010. Charlotte is a seasoned performer, I would say, looking at the list that I have. She's performed at the 100 Club, Buckingham Palace, the Royal Festival Hall in New York, most recently at Glastonbury Festival and Latitude, and also at the Proms Plus Late at the Royal Albert Hall. She runs a night called Speakeasy, which is a brand new Cambridge-based spoken word night. Welcome to the stage, please, Charlotte Higgins.
Thank you very much. The first poem I'm going to read is called Funeral Ties, and it is for Jeremy Taylor. Funeral ties. The morning they buried someone we'd known who had died. I met my friends' last-minute steps on their shoe-shined way to M&S to buy themselves each a good black tie. Later, our tutor told us when his old tutor passed away, it was the first funeral he'd gone to. He bought a tie for it himself, brand new. And every time he wears it now, he remembers that goodbye. At the service, it wasn't until they played the Spurs theme song that everybody cried. We stood outside, our tongues wreathed with sorry for your loss. We didn't know yet how to come across as if we knew what they were going through. The newly cold wind tangled our hair as I stood between these boys who aren't boys anymore, who each stand a full head taller than me in their shine shoes, sharp wrist bones, their shirt sleeves. His wife said she was so thankful we were there. I thought, may all our shoulders be broad enough for all that they'll have to bear.
I feel like there's been something of a trend of starting with a grim one, so I thought I'd kind of go along. But to counteract that, the next poem I'm going to read, I haven't read anywhere before. The first of my friends to get married, got married a few weeks ago, which is a little bit terrifying, but it was very exciting. It was a lovely day, and I wrote a poem for their wedding. And I thought I couldn't really read it anywhere before I'd actually shown it to them, so I haven't told it to anyone else before, so you're the first. But it's about, I don't know if anyone knows Bradwell-on-Sea in Essex, but it's this incredibly remote chapel, very, very old and right on a cliff, and that's where they got married. So the poem that I wrote for them is called Saltwater and Sky, and it's for Rachel and Sam. We are so close to the sea that I can taste the salt water on my skin even from inside. The windows are up by the roof and small, but the room is self-sufficient with light. Until just at this moment, I'm not sure I understood all that has gone on between these bare stone walls, the footsteps they have been listener to. The aisle my still young friends are walking through has been worn right down through a layer of stone by other footsteps that have walked this aisle themselves and walked back out together and been gone. These aisles, these crucibles, these May Day afternoons with all of our friends sat on the wooden pews in our summer dresses and wide eyes, holding hands for warmth and for dear life, will become rings on fingers, will become the people I see alone on the tube on the way to work in the morning, the bands through which they are tied back to someone, somewhere else, so that I know just to look at them that someone loves them, will become a house together, and walks by the seaside and years of life under the same piece of sky. I wish you salt water and a clear blue sky. I could not wish you more love and light than this, if I tried. And so I have, I've just finished university and I've moved to London, which is a little bit terrifying, but one thing that I've been doing is writing poems about people I see on the tube, usually afterwards, so as not to kind of freak people out too much. But I thought I'd share one of those. And it's they're called Love Notes to Strangers on the Tube. And this is, I think, like the third one. And I saw the guy like going down the escalator in King's Cross. It is a bit creepy. To the Japanese man with the deep-lined, handsome face, wearing a soft navy cardigan beneath your elegant suit. You make me think of buttons, of process, of your hands in the morning 13 hours before, now working methodically on the buttons in a room somewhere in a home. Maybe looking into the mirror. Perhaps some other soft hands reach into the picture and do up the final buttons. And I will read one more short one and then a slightly longer one. And the short one is called Rice. Last week it was confetti. This week it is rice. I pass the church door every day on my way home, and it is nice to see their happiness spill out onto the street. How they have so much joy that they can give us this for free. I do keep missing the ceremonies. But it is nice to know that there is such joy even when we are not looking, that there is so much joy around. And maybe I'd never have noticed if not for the rice on the ground. Before I finish, I just want to say thank you so much for having me. And the last poem I'm going to read is going to lower the tone somewhat. It's, you know, whenever you start to type a phrase into Google and Google automatically comes up with the rest for you. So this poem is, I didn't realise for a really long time that that's based on what other people have most commonly searched for before you, which puts some of the things that come up in like an entirely new light. So whenever I found that out, I wrote a poem made up of things that come up whenever you start to type a phrase into Google. And it was actually last year, I realised in reading it over that it's, you can date it incredibly specifically based on what people were looking for. And so I might have to do an updated version, but for now this is it, and it's called Autocomplete. God is dead. God is love. God is not dead. God is an astronaut. I am learning. I am legend. I am Groot. I am feeling lucky. Are olives good for you? Are 0300 numbers free? Are ghosts real? Are mermaids real? Are vampires real? Are you there? How will we evolve? How will we defeat ISIS? How will we recognise the Antichrist? How will we love? Does anyone actually know what time it is? Does anyone survive Ebola? Does anyone still use MySpace? Does anyone actually live in Greenland? Love is strange. Love is kind. Love is patient. Love is an open door. Is love real? Is love at first sight? Is love enough? Why is he ignoring me? Why is he avoiding me? Why is he not texting me back? Why is she ignoring me? Why is she avoiding me? Why is she wearing leggings? Should I stay or should I go? Brackets, lyrics. Should I update to iOS 8? Should I text him? Should I get a flu shot? Should one get married? Should one tip for takeout? Should one always tell the truth? Should one invest in gold? Are we done yet? Are we officially dating? Are we going to war? Are we there yet? What do we think of Tottenham? What do we say to the god of death? What do we do with a drunken sailor? What do we mean to each other? What do contractions feel like? What do dreams mean? What do hedgehogs eat? What do they know? What are carbs? What are prime numbers? What are the Ten Commandments? What are your weaknesses? What are we looking for? What are we looking for? What are we looking for? Thank you very much.
Well, thanks ever so much to you, poets. Fantastic readings, really. I've been thrilled and moved and energised. And if there's a case to be made, I think, for supporting young people's poetry, the case has just been made. So thank you very much. And I just wanted to say that if you are a young person, 11 to 17, or looking around the room, if you know a young person who writes poetry, please do encourage them to enter the 2016, no insults here, to enter the Foyle Young Poets competition. The deadline's the 31st of July. It's completely free. There's no set theme, and all the information can be found on the Poetry Society's website. I think you'll find a flyer on your seat about that, and there's also anthologies of the 2015 Foyle Young Poet winners and commended poets at the door, so you can take one as you go out. Great, and I'll pass you over to Neil, but thanks again. Another round of applause for the poets.